Journey to the West, Chapter 1.
And our mission today is to really unpack this opening. We're talking world creation, the unique cosmology, and of course, the amazing birth of Sun Wukong, the Monkey King himself.
Exactly. From that first chapter, the one titled, "The Spiritual Roots Sprouts and Bears, the Nature and Life Are Cultivated on the Great Path." It sets such a tone.
And it jumps right in with something pretty big, pretty grand right from the start.
It really does. These opening lines, it seems to link something personal, like inner work, with everything.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Nurturing spiritual roots.
Yeah.
All beings looking to benevolence. All things becoming good. It's quite the opening statement.
And then the kicker? Hey, if you want to understand the universe's creation,
you need to read Journey to the West. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So not like a scientific treatise or some dense philosophy.
It's a novel, classic fantastical journey. That's apparently where the secrets to cosmic creation lie.
Unexpected, to say the least. It makes you wonder, what is in Journey to the West that connects to the Big Bang or, well, the origins of everything?
Right. What kind of insights are supposedly hidden in there? And then, almost immediately, it gives us this poem.
Ah, yes, the poem. "Since Pangu broke the primordial chaos."
And from that, the clear and turbid were separated. Order from chaos.
So Pangu, for anyone maybe not familiar, he's the cosmic giant in mythology, right? Separated heaven and earth.
That's the one. The very act of creation, bringing structure to the formless void.
And the poem continues, "Before that separation, chaos reigned. Heaven and earth all mixed up."
Vast, empty, unseen, just pure potential maybe, or just pure chaos.
So you've got this link, cultivating your mind nature, your inner self, that prit bit.
Uh-huh.
And then bam, Journey to the West holds the key to creation.
Right.
Which started with Pangu bringing order, separating clear from turbid, out of this massive unseen chaos described in the poem.
It's quite a chain of ideas in just a few lines. It's suggesting that understanding yourself, that inner work, might actually mirror or connect to how the universe itself came into being.
Hmm.
From that chaotic state to, well, order.
Huh. So the personal journey reflects the cosmic one. Is that the idea?
It seems to be pointing that way. That maybe the principles are related somehow. That self-cultivation isn't just about you. It's about understanding fundamental reality.
That's a pretty profound thought. That getting a handle on the merit of creation isn't just an intellectual exercise.
No, it involves engaging with this story, this epic journey, and maybe implicitly undertaking your own inner journey. It really does. Between the micro-personal cultivation and the macro-cosmic creation. And Journey to the West is somehow the bridge.
Or the manual, maybe.
Yeah, and challenges us to see this classic story not just as fantasy.
But as potentially holding keys. Keys to understanding existence, right? From that initial, that undividing chaos.
Before Pangu brought order.
Mm.
It frames the story as deeply significant.
How often do we dismiss old stories, myths, you know, allegories as just stories?
Right, as primitive or irrelevant to, like, quantum physics or cosmology.
Exactly. But what if texts like this are suggesting these narratives offer a different kind of insight, a unique lens on those huge questions about reality?
Yeah, could these ancient ways of explaining the world hold, I don't know, surprising truths about the fabric of the universe that maybe we've overlooked? It's definitely something to think about.
The whole deal.
And then we get this timeline, which is kind of mind-bending. Yuan is 129,600 years.
Yeah, and that's divided into 12 huis, each 10,800 years long, linked to the earthly branches. It's vast.
Almost impossible to grasp. But then, okay, the text connects this huge cosmic cycle to a single day. Why do that? Why link the immense and the tiny?
Well, I think it's about showing interconnectedness, you know? A core idea in Chinese thought.
Yeah.
The universe's patterns echo in our daily lives. Macrocosm, microcosm.
Right, right. It's not just dates on a calendar. It's a pattern.
Exactly. A recurring cycle. And the text walks us through it from chaos, the first light stirrings Xiao Yang wrote about.
Ah, yes. That quote about the winter solstice. One yang stirs, but all things are not yet born. Beautiful.
It is. And then it lays out the stages. Heaven opening and the Zihui, sun, moon, stars appearing.
Then the earth solidifying in Xiao. With the five elements showing up, water, fire, mountain, stone, earth. Are those the basic building blocks here?
Essentially, yes. Not just physical stuff, but the fundamental forces shaping reality. Their appearance marks the shift from, let's say, the abstract to the concrete. order emerging.
Okay, and then comes Yang, and life appears, humans too, establishing the three powers, heaven, earth, humanity. We hear that a lot. What's the significance?
It means the cosmos is complete, basically. And humanity isn't separate. We're an integral part alongside heaven and earth. There's a sense of balance, interdependence. Humans have a role.
Such a huge stage set for our main character. And then, bam, the focus shifts from cosmic time to geography. Four big continents. Why these four, and why zoom in on East Purvavidya?
Well, the four continents idea, that comes often from Buddhist cosmology, which was a huge influence. East Purvavidya is often seen as maybe more natural, idyllic, a fitting place for someone like Sun Wukong to be born.
Makes sense. So within this continent, we get the country of Aeolai near the sea and Flower Fruit Mountain.
Ah, yes. Flower Fruit Mountain.
And it's not just any mountain, is it? The text calls it an ancestral vein, existing since chaos was split. That's quite the pedigree for a mountain.
It really is. It tells you this place is special. It's ancient, powerful, a nexus point, you could say, where extraordinary things can happen because it's so connected to the origins of everything.
And the description. Majesty awing the jeweled sea, crimson cliffs, wondrous peaks. It sounds incredible. Teeming with life, phoenixes, unicorns, everlasting flowers. And it's right at the very summit of this extraordinary, cosmically significant mountain that the text introduces the central object of this origin story, an immortal stone, a rush.
The source doesn't just mention a stone. It immediately tells us its precise dimensions and connects them to fundamental cosmic and calendrical cycles, signaling that this is no ordinary rock.
Yeah, the details are amazing. It says the stone is 3-4 he high, which, the text points out, matches the 365 degrees of the celestial circuit, the path of the stars, and it's 2 year-round, matching the 24 solar terms of the agricultural calendar, which govern the seasons.
It even has 9 openings and 8 holes, linked to the text to the 9 palaces and 8 trigrams, fundamental arrangements used in cosmology and divination.
So its very form echoes the structure of the universe.
Exactly. Its structure and placement on this mountain are explicitly linked to the very fabric of the universe and its rhythms.
And the text gives us the reason for its special nature. It explains that ever since the world opened, the stone has been absorbing the heavenly truth in earthly beauty and the essence of the sun and the essence of the moon.
Soaking it all in for eons.
Yeah.
Having absorbed these vital cosmic and earthly energies for such an immense period, the source tells us it developed a sense of spiritual awareness or sentience.
Wow.
And deep within it, it nurtured an immortal embryo.
An immortal embryo inside the stone. Then comes the pivotal moment the text has been setting up. One day, the stone burst open.
Just cracked right open. From within it came a stone egg, described as being like a large spherical ball.
A stone egg. And the miraculous transformation. The text says that when this stone egg was exposed to the wind, it immediately transformed into a stone monkey.
Instantaneously. And the source is clear, this wasn't a gradual process after birth. It was fully formed the moment the wind touched it, with all its senses and limbs complete.
That is such a unique origin. What does the text imply by having this being born in this specific way? From a stone absorbing cosmic essence on a foundational mountain.
Well, it strongly connects this being to the very origins and fundamental nature of the universe we just discussed, doesn't it?
Yeah, it seems so.
It's not born of flesh and blood, or even from the standard cycles of life and death in the human or animal realm. It's born from the distilled essence of the cosmos and the earth itself, on a mountain described as a root of the world.
So something elemental.
It suggests an extraordinary, almost elemental nature right from the start.
And this birth doesn't go unnoticed. At least not initially. The text describes something dramatic happening immediately. The monkey's eyes shot up 2 beams of golden light.
Big beams. And these beams didn't just glow locally. The text says they shot straight up, shooting up to the celestial palace.
Right up to the top.
Hmm.
And who sits at the very top of that celestial palace? The supreme ruler of the celestial realm, as described in this text, the Jade Emperor.
The Jade Emperor, yeah. Presiding from his high palace, the golden cloud palace, spiritual sky treasured hall, he saw this blazing golden light.
Must have been quite a sight.
You'd think so. The source tells us he gathered his celestial officials, his Aku, and commanded his cosmic observers, Thousand Mile Eye and Winda.
Great names.
To look through the southern heavenly gate and investigate this phenomenon from below.
What's fascinating here is the immediate top-level reaction from the highest authority in the celestial hierarchy. They see it, they investigate it directly, no delay.
And the text tells us the generals carried out the command, saw clearly, heard distinctly, and reported back the location, Dongsheng Shenzhou, the small country of Aolai, Flower Fruit Mountain.
Okay.
They confirmed seeing the stone, the egg, the wind-transformed monkey, it's bowing to the four directions, and of course, the light.
But then the report adds a crucial detail, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Something about the light.
Yes, exactly. They note that the light is already subsiding. Having taken food and water, the golden light is about to dim or cease. The initial celestial spectacle is fading as the monkey settles into its new existence.
Ah, so the cosmic alarm is already turning off. The big show is over. And what was the Jade Emperor's final judgment on this miraculous light-shooting birth?
Well, the text says he graciously bestowed mercy or favor, stating that this was simply a thing from below, born from the essence of heaven and earth, nothing to be surprised by.
This place, Flower Fruit Mountain, it sounds... well, idyllic.
It really does. The descriptions are just full of life, grass, trees, water, flowers, fruit, everything.
Yeah.
And the monkeys, our guy included, they're just completely part of it all, living with wolves, tigers, deer.
Like a natural paradise. And they're just playing, foraging, grooming.
Yeah, living this carefree life. And there's that line, mountain has no calendar, cold ends without knowing the year.
Ah, right. That really struck me, too, this sense of timelessness.
Exactly. It emphasizes this sort of cyclical, nature-driven existence. No clocks, no calendars.
Which makes you wonder, you know, what kind of creature comes out of that?
Yeah.
And how does he eventually deal with, say, the very structured world of the heavens?
That's a great question. It sets up a potential clash right away.
So then we get this moment. It feels almost accidental. It's hot. They're looking for shade.
And there's some pine trees, yeah.
And they notice this stream. And just like that, out of this simple, everyday thing, boom, history changes.
It's funny how that works, isn't it? How huge events can spin out of something so, so ordinary. And it starts as a group thing, too.
Oh, yeah.
The text says something like, let's go have some fun and see where this water comes from. It's communal curiosity at first.
So it wasn't initially his idea, the stone monkey's idea.
Not the initial let's follow the stream part, no. That seems to be the whole group. Which makes his later actions stand out even more. It wasn't some grand quest they set out on, just let's see what's upriver.
And upriver turns out to be this massive waterfall. The descriptions are pretty wild.
Oh, fantastic imagery. White rainbow, 1,000-foot snow waves.
Like a hanging curtain. It feels like a real barrier. Something powerful, maybe a bit scary.
Definitely awe-inspiring. And... well, what do monkeys do when they see something like that?
They dare each other.
Pretty much. They say, okay, whoever is brave enough to go through it, find the source, and come back safe and sound, that monkey gets to be king.
Just like that, a dare becomes the path to kingship.
Seems like it. It's playful, maybe, but it sets up a test. Hmm? Courage, initiative, maybe a bit of recklessness. It tells you what they value, perhaps.
And bang. The stone monkey, he's not even called Monkey King yet. He just steps up. I'll go in.
Instantly. No thinking it over. Just pure confidence. Action.
It almost feels like destiny. The text even says something like, today his fragrant name appears. Like it was meant to be.
Yeah. When fortune comes, great luck arrives. It hints at something preordained, doesn't it?
What do you make of that? That immediate sense of, this is my moment.
Well, it's a huge contrast to that group curiosity from before, right? This is purely individual. It suggests maybe an inner drive, something that just sets him apart right from the start.
The confidence that we definitely see again later. A lot.
Oh, absolutely. It's core to his character.
So he takes the plunge, closes his eyes, jumps, and then he lands not in water, but on a bridge.
Exactly. A bright, clear space behind the waterfall. No water, no waves. It's completely unexpected. Like stepping into Narnia or something.
Whoa. So the world of Journey to the West isn't quite what it seems on the surface then.
Right away you get that sense. Magic, hidden realities tucked away inside the ordinary world. The bridge itself is described as an iron slab spanning a stone aperture.
Sounds almost man-made or deity-made.
It does, but it's presented as just being there. That blurring of natural and artificial, real and fantastic, that's classic Journey to the West.
And beyond this bridge, it's like a whole hidden apartment.
Kind of, like someone's residence, the text says, but still very natural. Blue moss, white clouds hanging around, quiet rooms.
Stalactites like burls, even traces of a fire by a stove, remnants of food.
Mm-hmm. That detail is fascinating. Who was here before? It adds this layer of mystery.
Yeah, like echoes of the past, maybe other immortals, or
yeah,
who knows?
Exactly. It hints that this blessed land has a history we don't know yet.
And then he spots it, the stone tablet. His reaction is pure joy, right? Overcome.
Totally. And joy, not, yeah, Z, self, control. He just can't contain his happiness.
And the inscription, Flower Fruit Mountain, Blessed Land, Water Curtain Cave, Heavenly Abode. That sounds important.
Oh, it's hujely significant. Blessed Land, Fuji in Chinese culture. That's a place with immense spiritual energy, good fortune, great for, you know, cultivation.
And Heavenly Abode.
That often means a grotto heaven, a sacred cave, maybe a portal, a place immortals dwell. So the tablet isn't just naming it, it's stamping it with profound spiritual meaning.
Okay, so he's found paradise, basically. He rushes back out.
Shouting, great fortune, great fortune. He's ecstatic.
But the other monkeys, their first question is,
how deep is the water?
Right. They're still stuck on the practical problem, the danger.
It really shows the difference, doesn't it? He sees the potential, the reward. They're still focused on the obstacle. It highlights his visionary quality, leader quality.
So he has to explain, no, there's an iron bridge. And inside, a whole house, ready-made.
And Tiezo di Sheda Jianling, a home furnished by heaven and earth. He lays it all out. Stone, stove, bowls, beds, everything. Shelter from wind, rain, snow.
He's selling it. He's not just the brave one. He's the persuasive one, too. He knows what they need.
He really does. He taps right into their desire for safety and comfort. And it works.
They go nuts, basically.
Total chaos. Rushing in, grabbing things, moving stuff. The text calls it their mischievous monkey nature.
It's a great little moment of, you know, monkeyness.
Brings it back down to earth for a second, yeah. But it also shows why they need a leader, someone to bring order.
And that's his cue. He steps up again.
Reminds them of the deal. Hey guys, remember the promise?
Who went in? Who found this amazing place? Who came back safe?
I did all that, so.
I should be king. It's logical, almost like a contract.
It is. And they agree immediately. No arguments. They all bow down.
Great king, 1,000 years.
And he takes the throne. But then there's that little detail about his name.
Right. He becomes the handsome monkey king, Niaowang. He drops the stone part.
Seems like it. He conceals the character Shh for stone. It's like a little rebranding.
Interesting. Why do that, do you think?
Maybe shedding his purely natural origin, becoming something more refined, or just establishing his own identity as leader, separate from just being the one born from stone. It marks a transition.
And that ends with this really profound poem.
Yeah, it kind of zooms out and puts everything in perspective, sums up his whole birth and hints at the future.
Lines like, a celestial stone containing the essence of sun and moon. That really drives home his unique origins.
Absolutely. And using an egg to transform into a monkey, completing the great dough.
Okay, the egg is the stone.
Yeah.
Right, like a gestation. But completing the great dough, what does that mean here so early on?
Good question. At this stage, it probably means fulfilling his initial destiny, like emerging as this perfectly formed, unique being. He's realized the potential inherent in that stone. It's not full enlightenment yet, obviously, but it's the completion of his creation according to the Tao, the fundamental way of the universe.
Wow. And it gets even deeper. Inner contemplation reveals the formless, outer observation perceives the formed.
Mm-hmm. It's connecting his personal story from potential inside the stone, formless, to the monkey king, formed, to these bigger philosophical ideas.
Throughout history, all belong to this category. Claiming kingship and sainthood, acting freely, it's placing him on this huge canvas.
Exactly. It elevates him beyond just an animal king. He's part of a cosmic pattern. And that mention of sainthood, big foreshadowing for where his journey eventually leads. The handsome monkey king living with his whole troop monkeys, macaque, intikias, and like this idyllic place, Flower Fruit Mountain.
And their amazing home, the Water Curtain Cave. They live in incredible harmony. The source describes it as just pure enjoyment.
How so?
Well, you know, gathering flowers in spring, finding fruits all summer, then harvesting yams and chestnuts in autumn, and digging for rhizomes in winter.
Just completely free, like utterly unbound by any rules, mythical beasts, human kings, nothing.
And this goes on for centuries. That's their reality.
Wow.
Yeah, the text specifically mentions 300 to 500 years of this kind of effortless bliss.
Wow.
It really sets this deep baseline of natural perfection.
The source paints such a vivid picture, doesn't it? Their unity, their freedom,
mm-hmm.
and those specific seasonal feasts, spring flowers, summer fruits, autumn yams, chestnuts, winter rhizomes. It really hammers home this life of pure joy, just living naturally for centuries.
You really get that sense of total contentment, yeah.
And that long period, like you said, that harmonious natural living is so key because it makes the turning point feel, well, really jarring.
Absolutely. It stands out.
Which brings us right to that moment. One day, smack in the middle of one of those happy feasts with his troop, the handsome Monkey King suddenly just gets sad.
Out of nowhere.
Yeah. The source says he actually breaks down and sheds tears. And this is after centuries of perfect happiness, having, you know, seemingly everything.
It's completely unexpected for the king of a place like that.
Right. And the monkeys are just baffled. They immediately ask him, "Why are you sad, great king? We're all so happy here. We're free."
Mm. They just can't get their heads around it. They don't understand his sorrow at all.
No. And that's when the Monkey King explains this far-reaching worry that suddenly hit him.
Okay.
He tells them, despite their freedom now, he's worried about the future. He fears getting old, his blood weakening, and eventually being controlled by the king of hell.
The big fear.
Yeah, the fear is that facing death ultimately means his whole long, happy life would have basically been lived in vain. No permanence.
Wow. So even in paradise, that fear of mortality just strikes him hard.
It does. And the monkey's reaction, it really shows the impact. The text says they all cover their faces and cry too. Suddenly, they get it.
They grasp the inescapable nature of aging and death.
It shifts from maybe some abstract thing to this terrifying reality for all of them right there.
Yeah, it becomes very real.
But then just as despair sets in, there's this flicker of hope out of the troop steps. The
three-back ape.
Yeah. And this ape speaks up with what sounds like, well, a potential solution.
Okay, what is it?
This ape identifies three kinds of beings who are explicitly not subject to the king of hell, beings who can escape the cycle of rebirth.
Who are they?
They are the Sutta-Wapu, Buddhas, immortals, and sacred beings.
Ah, the ones who figured it out.
Exactly. And how do they escape? What's their secret?
Well, the ape explains that these beings, they achieve immortality. They literally do not die or perish.
Wow.
They live as long as heaven and earth, mountains and rivers. So they offer the ultimate escape from the very worry that just overwhelmed the Monkey King.
And crucially, where can they be found?
The ape says they're out there. The Yanfu world, basically our mortal realm, living in ancient caves and immortal mountains.
Okay, so this is it. This is the moment. The source says upon hearing this, the Monkey King's heart is just instantly filled with joy.
A complete turnaround.
Total turnaround. And he immediately decides he has to leave the mountain the very next day to go find them.
And this decision, it's presented as the absolute catalyst, isn't it, for everything that comes after?
Absolutely. The text explicitly says this single thought, Anano, instantly taught him to jump out of the net of reincarnation.
And that's the reason.
That's the reason Esau caused the great sage equal to heaven to be formed. This fear of death and just this glimmer of a solution, that's the Genesis moment.
It's the spark for his entire quest, his whole legendary status. It all starts right here.
And the monkey's reaction to his decision is actually pretty touching. They don't try and stop him.
No.
No, they enthusiastically agree to send him off with this grand farewell banquet.
Oh, that's nice.
And the description of this feast is incredible. They gather immortal peaches, exotic fruits, dig up yam, pull rhizomes. And then there's this ridiculously long list of fruits and prepared foods.
Oh, yeah. Like what?
Okay, get this. Cherry plums, ripe plums, longans, lychees, crab apples, loquats, rabbit head pears, chicken heart dates, fragrant peaches, rotten apricots, crisp plums, bayberries, watermelons, persimmons, pomegranates,
wow.
Yams, chestnuts, walnuts, ginkgos, coconuts, grapes, hazels, pines, terray nuts, plums, oranges, mandarins, pomelos, plus cook stuff like stewed yam and boiled rhizomes and drinks from coconuts and grapes.
That's almost like a human feast in its variety and preparation. It's pretty amazing.
That is, isn't it? A really striking display of their connection, their affection, shows a capacity for like culture and celebration beyond just grabbing fruit.
Yeah, it really underscores what he's potentially leaving behind, that community.
Definitely. So the next day, the departure itself is described quite simply. Monkey King wakes early, gets the monkeys to build him a raft from dead pine branches,
resourceful,
finds a bamboo pole for rowing, packs some provisions, and just sets off, alone, onto this vast, seemingly endless sea.
And right here, the text injects that sense of destiny again, doesn't it?
It does. How so?
You know, it was his destiny arriving, or maybe it was his fated time.
Uh-huh.
And that strong southeast winds, they didn't just blow him randomly. They carried him specifically directly to the northwest shore.
Of where?
Of the southern Jambu continent. So fate seems to be actively guiding this quest right from the get-go. It's not just chance.
Okay, so he lands on this new shore, ditches the raft, and immediately starts just observing people.
His first contact with humans.
Yeah, people fishing, hunting geese, gathering clams, making salt by the sea. He's finally entered the human world.
And his very first interaction is, well, it's pure Monkey King mischief, isn't it?
It really is. He decides to basically play a trick, pretending to be a tiger.
Oh, boy.
Scares the people on the shore, terrifies them, they run off. He grabs one poor guy who wasn't fast enough, takes his clothes, puts them on himself, and then just awkwardly starts walking into towns and cities.
You know, that moment tells you so much about him. He has this incredible, like, innate ability to mimic and adapt instantly.
Yeah, sees clothes, figures out their use, even if he's clumsy.
Right. But it also just screams his complete lack of understanding of human social norms beyond the surface stuff. His first instinct isn't talking, it's trickery.
So as he travels through these towns and cities, he starts learning human manners, human speech. But what he notices about human life is really striking, especially coming from where he came from.
What does he see?
He sees everyone is just focused on Basate Sakai same and seizing profit.
Mm. That's quite the observation.
Yeah, and it really highlights this profound contrast, doesn't it, between his path and the path of the humans he's now watching.
Absolutely. It defines his journey against theirs.
He looks around and finds, not a single one who cares about their own life, meaning their ultimate mortality or, you know, spiritual well-being.
They're distracted.
Totally. He sees people constantly striving for more. The source has that line, riding a donkey but thinking of a fine horse, being prime minister but hoping for royalty.
And this is where the irony just hits you, right? Humans, who are mortal, who are subject to the king of hell, the very thing the Monkey King fears so much.
Yeah.
They're utterly consumed by temporary material gains that won't mean a thing the moment they die. They seem completely unafraid of the exact thing that kicked off his whole quest.
It's bizarre.
Not one is willing to turn back from this relentless chase for worldly stuff.
Are they just oblivious? Or is it, like you said, they've just prioritized totally different things?
That's the question the text leaves hanging, I think.
It's such a powerful contrast, though. He's terrified of death, leaves paradise to find immortality.
While the mortal beings he meets seem oblivious to their own end, just chasing things that won't last.
And despite seeing all this human activity, learning their ways, the source makes it absolutely clear. The Monkey King's original focus hasn't shifted one bit.
No, his one heart is singularly fixed on that goal.
Uh-huh.
Visiting the Wobu Hall, the way of the Buddhas, immortals, and sacred beings.
And finding the method for eternal life, that initial fear, that pursuit of immortality, it's still his only driving force, cuts right through all the distractions of the human world.
Absolutely.
So quite a journey already, from this king of paradise living in pure, natural joy, to being a solitary traveler, watching the strange, grasping nature of human life.
All sparked by that single, overwhelming fear of getting old, weakening, and, well, dying. The text says he spends something like 8 or 9 years just wandering across this huge area, the southern Jambu Dvipa.
Which is basically like a whole continent in the story's world.
Exactly. Crossing huge distances, seeing, you know, big walled cities, little villages. It really paints a picture of this restless energy, this curiosity just pushing him onward.
But it's not entirely aimless, is it? He starts getting this idea, this inkling.
Mm-hmm. He starts to think that, you know, beyond the ocean, there must be something. More. Immortals, maybe. The secret to living forever.
Yeah, that belief starts to form.
And it's not just a vague hope. He actually does something about it. He builds himself a raft.
Which is incredible. I'm crossing the ocean now.
Right. Imagine the sheer will that takes. And he sets off, crosses the Western Ocean. That act itself, it just screams determination, doesn't it? Even this early on.
It really does. So this massive journey gets him to the Western continent. But he doesn't just, you know, stick a flag in the sand and say, made it.
Yeah, no. Definitely not. The search keeps going. The story really emphasizes how persistent he is, traveling all over this new land.
Yeah.
And then he finds it, this mountain.
Ah, yes, the mountain. And the way it's described, it's just, wow, thousands of peaks range like halberds.
10,000 cliffs unfolded like a screen. It's incredibly evocative language. You really get a sense of this immense, almost intimidating natural beauty.
You do. And it goes on, right? Describing the light, the plants.
Oh, yeah. Sunshine filtering through mist, the coolness after rain, ancient vines, old trees, luxuriant bamboo and tall pines. It says evergreen for 10,000 years. Mm. It feels ancient, powerful.
Like a place where something important must be happening. You can feel the significance.
Definitely. And the Monkey King, he senses this too. Even though the text mentions, you know, wolves, tigers, real dangers.
He's not scared off at all.
Not in the slightest.
Yeah.
He's completely zeroed in on his goal. And he gets this strong feeling, this intuition, that a place this majestic has to be hiding someone special, a great sage.
Right. He's thinking, this is the kind of place an immortal would live.
Exactly. And just as he's taking all this in, this huge, quiet landscape, he hears something.
Not an animal this time.
No. It's singing, drifting out from deep in the woods.
And the song itself is interesting. It paints this picture of a very simple life.
Yeah, very grounded life.
Yeah.
Watching chess games forever, chopping wood, you know, selling it for a bit of wine, laughing.
Sleeping under the stars.
Right. Contentment and simplicity.
Sure.
Recognize the old forest, climb cliffs, cross ridges, wield the axe to cut dry vines. It's very earthy.
But then there are those lines, the ones that make the Monkey King stop in his tracks.
Ah, yes. The crucial bit. In places we meet, they are either immortals or followers of the Tao, quietly expounding the Yellow Court classic.
Boom. That's the trigger, isn't it?
That's absolutely the trigger. He hears that and thinks, that's it. Immortals. Finally. He just dives into the forest, searching for the singer.
He must be buzzing with excitement after all this travel.
Totally. Only to find, well, not quite what he expected.
Yeah. It's not some glowing, ethereal being. It's
a
woodcutter.
It's just a guy chopping wood, wearing a simple bamboo hat, rough clothes, carrying his axe.
Yeah.
Very ordinary, very down to earth.
Which is such a great twist, isn't it? Wisdom isn't always where you think you'll find it.
Exactly. The woodcutter's appearance is described so practically. Coarse clothes, rope belt, straw sandals. He's clearly a working man.
And the Monkey King, bless him, he's so eager. He rushes up and greets him like,
old immortal, your disciple pays his respects.
Can you imagine? This poor woodcutter must have jumped out of his skin.
Right. He's completely baffled, denies it straight away. No, no, you've got the wrong guy. Look at me. I can barely afford food or clothes. How could I be an immortal?
He calls himself clumsy, even.
Yeah, very humble. But the Monkey King, he's sharp. He picks up on the song lyrics.
Basically says, okay, if you're not an immortal, how come you were singing immortal words? He caught that line about the Tao and the Yellow Court classic.
And this is where it gets really interesting. The woodcutter explains, oh, that song, it's called Man Ting Fang.
Right, not his own words.
No. He says an immortal neighbor taught it to him. Saw him worrying about life, you know, struggling day to day.
Wow.
And this immortal neighbor just taught him the song to ease his mind, to give him some peace.
So it's like spiritual wisdom, but used in this really practical, almost therapeutic way.
Precisely. The woodcutter isn't seeking enlightenment in the same way the Monkey King is. He's just received this gift, a tool for well-being, from someone who happens to be an immortal living next door.
It's so casual, like getting a helpful tip from Dave down the street, except Dave is, you know, a celestial being.
Exactly. And it really highlights this idea that wisdom isn't always found through intense solitary searching. Sometimes it just seeps into everyday life. It's a different model, maybe a more compassionate one.
Which naturally gets the Monkey King thinking. His reaction is pure Monkey King, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. He basically says, well, if you live next to an immortal, why don't you just go learn the secret to eternal life from him? You're right there.
Seems logical from his perspective. Go get the power.
You'd think so. But the woodcutter's answer is really quite touching. He refuses.
Why?
Filial piety. He explains he has an elderly mother at home. He's her sole provider. He has responsibilities. He needs to chop wood, sell it, buy rice. He can't just abandon her to go off seeking immortality.
And the Monkey King actually respects that, doesn't he?
He does. He immediately recognizes the woodcutter's virtue. Calls him a virtuous gentleman of filial piety. It's a little glimpse, maybe, of the Monkey King's own capacity for understanding morality, even if his main drive is different.
It shows a bit of depth starting to emerge. But he doesn't let go of his own goal.
Not for a second. He pivots straight away. Okay, you're not coming, you can't learn immortality. But can you at least tell me where this immortal lives?
The crucial question.
And finally, the payoff. The woodcutter gives him the details.
This is the big clue he's been searching for years.
Exactly. The name of the mountain. Lingtai Fankun Mountain.
Which itself has interesting meanings related to the mind or spirit.
It does. And the cave within it. The Slanting Moon Three Stars Cave. Another name full of Taoist symbolism.
And crucially, the name of the master who lives there.
Patriarch Subhuti. And the woodcutter adds that Subhuti already has loads of disciples studying there. It's a known place, a real center of learning.
It confirms the Monkey King's intuition was right. There is a great sage here.
Definitely. And he even gets directions.
Like ancient GPS?
Pretty much. Follow that little path south, he says, for about 7 or 8 left.
Which is, what, 2 or 3 miles? A decent walk, but clear instructions.
Very clear. Actionable intelligence finally setting him on the right track.
But of course, the Monkey King can't just leave it there. He has one last try, right?
Yes. Classic Monkey King impulsiveness. He tries to convince the woodcutter to come with him. Come on, guide me there.
Probably thinking it would be quicker, safer.
Maybe, but the woodcutter gently, firmly refuses again.
And explains why, again.
Right. He basically says, look, I told you, my mom needs me, I need to work. You clearly don't understand my situation. It's a kind rebuke, highlighting the difference in their circumstances.
It really draws that contrast, doesn't it? The seeker focused solely on the goal versus the person living a life grounded in duty and connection.
It does. So the Monkey King's incredible drive gets him to the right place, more or less. Monkey King leaves the woods, follows this path, travels maybe, what, 7 or 8 lies?
Yeah, which for context is something like 2 or 3 miles. Not, you know, an epic trek at this point, but enough to transition him somewhere new.
And the place he finds.
Yeah.
Wow. It's just stunning, right?
Oh, absolutely breathtaking. The text really paints a picture. It describes this hidden cave dwelling set in this just magnificent landscape.
Yeah, it sounds like something out of a dream. Misty clouds, sunshine, these ancient cypress trees, 1,000 of them, green tips, rain-kissed, reaching for the sky.
And then down in the valley, you've got 10,000 sections of bamboo, tall bamboo, holding mist-like smoke. It gives this feeling of deep serenity and natural wonder.
The details keep layering on. Strange flowers like brocade, fragrant grass, mossy cliffs.
Long moss on steep walls. It feels ancient, untouched, sacred.
For sure. And then there's the life there. Immortal cranes calling out.
Loudly. Shaking the heavens, the text says, and phoenixes soaring their feathers like bright clouds.
It's not just the mythical birds either. You've got spirit monkeys, white deer just roaming free.
Golden lions, jade elephants sort of appearing. It's teeming with this magical life.
And the text flat out says,
yeah,
this place is better than heaven.
Which is quite a statement, isn't it? It frames it as the ultimate sanctuary. The kind of place you would find a true master.
Exactly. It builds this huge expectation. He finds this perfect spot, and the cave door is shut.
Right. Just closed. Silent. Seems like nobody's home.
Kind of anticlimax after that description.
For a moment, maybe.
But then he spots it, a stone tablet.
With the inscription.
Exactly.
Right.
Very auspicious.
And the name of the place? Spirit Mountain, Slanting Moon, and Three Stars Cave.
What's the deal with those names? Spirit Mountain sounds obvious enough.
Right. Lingtai Fankun Shan. Lingtai and Fankun both relate to the heart mind, the center of consciousness. So a place for inner cultivation.
And the cave. Slanting Moon, Three Stars. Shiyu Sangxing Dong.
That one's more mysterious. Mm. One interpretation is that the characters for Slanting Moon and Three Stars visually resemble the character for Heart, again, pointing to mind cultivation. Bingo! That's the place the woodcutter mentioned. You can just imagine his relief. He's found it.
He's obviously thrilled, yeah, but he doesn't, like, bang on the door immediately.
No, classic Monkey King, right? He hesitates, then hops up a pine tree nearby.
And just chills out, eating pine nuts, waiting.
Agrees. A bit of that wild monkey still there.
Mm-hmm.
But it works. After a little while, creak, the door opens.
And out comes this fairy child. The description makes the child sound, well, otherworldly.
Hmm.
Pure, detached, ageless almost.
A perfect gatekeeper for a place like this. Totally fits the vibe.
The child calls out, like, who's making noise out there?
And Monkey King, showing some real respect now, jumps down, bows, and says, you know, I'm a disciple seeking the way, seeking immortality. I wouldn't dare make trouble.
And here's where it gets really interesting. The child laughs and says something like, "Oh, a seeker. That's funny, my master."
Patriarch Bodhi.
Patriarch Bodhi was just starting his lesson and told me, "Go open the door. There's a seeker who has arrived. Bring him in."
Amazing foresight, right? The patriarch knew he was coming, expected him.
Huge validation for Monkey Bean.
Yeah.
He's like, "That's me. It's me."
Super excited.
So he quickly tries to, you know, straighten himself up, look presentable.
Tidy the robes, yeah. Then he follows the child inside.
And the inside sounds just as impressive. Deep chambers, palaces decorated with pearls and shells.
Quiet, secluded rooms. It's like going deeper and deeper into this sacred space.
Exactly. A journey inward. Until they reach a platform. And there he is, Patriarch Bodhi, sitting there with 30 smaller immortals attending him.
The description of the patriarch is pretty intense. Great awakened golden immortal, Western wondrous manifestation, beyond birth and death, full of spirit.
Basically the real deal. An ancient, incredibly powerful master.
No question. And Monkey King sees this.
And all that previous swagger just vanishes. He hits the ground, bowing over and over. "Master, master," just pure reverence.
The patriarch acknowledges him, but gets straight to the point. "Where are you from? What's your name?"
Monkey King gives the info. "Flowerfruit Mountain, Water Curtain Cave, Aeolite Country, East Continent."
And the patriarch's first reaction, skepticism, big time. Calls him a liar, basically.
Yeah, deceitful. He points out the geography. Two huge seas, the whole South Jambu continent. How could he get here?
Seems impossible. But Monkey King pleads his case, explains the journey took over 10 years. Floating, walking, searching.
That sheer determination, that decade of searching, seems to convince the patriarch.
Right. He says something like, "Okay, since you came gradually, then it's acceptable. The door is truly open now." But then the next question.
"What's your surname?"
And Monkey King is just blank. "Surname. I don't have one."
He explains his nature, like, "People insult me, I don't care, they hit me, I don't get mad." It's like, the concept is totally foreign.
So the patriarch clarifies, no, your family name, your parents' name.
Monkey King's answer is just as simple, no parents either.
Which leads the patriarch to guess, okay, maybe born from a tree.
And this is the big reveal. Monkey King corrects him. "Nope, not a tree, a stone. On Flowerfruit Mountain, there was this immortal stone, it split open, and out I came."
The text explicitly says the patriarch hears this and is secretly pleased. He recognizes him born from heaven and earth.
Ah, so his origin is actually a plus in the patriarch's eyes. It marks him as special.
Exactly. Innate potential. Then the patriarch tells him, "Okay, stand up. Walk around a bit."
Monkey King does his little hop walk thing.
And the patriarch watches him, observes his form, and that's the key. He smiles.
Says something like, "Yeah, you're built kind of rough, but you look like a Hugh Son of Macaque, basically."
"The kind that eats pine nuts," he adds. Based on that resemblance, he decides to give him a surname derived from Macaque, Hugh Son.
He focuses on the Son character. Now, the text goes into this detailed breakdown of the character's components.
Yeah, it gets pretty technical with radicals and meanings like ancient moon and sun thread. But the gist seems to be
that the character Son, when you strip away the part, meaning beast, leaves components suggesting child and infant, which the patriarch says fits the principle of an infant. It signifies a beginning, a potential.
So removing the beast aspect, focusing on the potential child within the monkey form, he lands on the surname Son.
Son. And Monkey King is ecstatic, like, "Great, awesome, I finally have a surname. Thank you, master." Bowing like crazy.
He's so happy, he immediately asks, "Okay, got the surname. Can I have a given name too? So, you know, people can call me something."
The patriarch then explains his system. He has a lineage, and disciples get names based on a set sequence of 12 characters.
Right. These 12 characters are vast, great, wisdom, true, suchness, nature, see, sharp, understanding, round, enlightenment. Each represents a stage or quality.
And he tells Monkey King, "You belong to the 10th generation."
Which corresponds to the 10th character in that poem.
Which is Wu. Meaning awaken or understand.
So put it together. Surname Sun, generational character Wu.
His full name is bestowed, Sun Wukong.
Sun Wukong. Awaken to emptiness. And Monkey King is just overjoyed, laughing, delighted. He finally has his full identity.
And the text wraps this up with this perfect little couplet. Originally a nameless since the dawn of chaos, to break through stubborn emptiness, one must become Wukong.
It ties everything together beautifully, doesn't it? His origin, nameless, chaotic, stubborn emptiness, and his destiny, which is to become Wukong, awakened to emptiness. The name itself is his path.